This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and this show is called Main Street because this is our Main Street this time of day, and we welcome you to join us with a discussion about something that people on Main Streets occasionally talk about, you know, something they saw or heard or, well, read that made them uncomfortable. And we're going to talk about the role artists play in creating discomfort with Bill Thomas. He's our director of radio. He also attended recently the UND Writers Conference in Grand Forks, where there was a provocative panel discussion about art that causes discomfort. And this is, of course, intentional, Bill.
Yes, these artists are ones who know that their work may make people uncomfortable because they're looking at things that made you think like, well, you know, we should do something about that, or it shouldn't be that way. Nicholas Galanin, who is the first one who speaks after the panel moderator, Kerry Campbell, who's a UND history professor, he is a Native American artist of Tlingit and Aleut ancestry from Sitka, Alaska. He's a multimedia artist and has done videos and installations and sculpture. And he talks a lot about the interplay between Native traditions and non-Native traditions. And he's bringing up things that he says, yeah, he knows they're uncomfortable, but he feels they must be brought up. And an interesting thing that Marlon James, the Jamaican novelist who writes about some of the uncomfortable history of Jamaica and the racial politics there, talks about kind of the battle between order and politics. And one thing he said struck me. He said, how do you deal with talking about uncomfortable things in your family? How do you talk about death?
Sure.
And that tells you something about how maybe you talk about a difficult political issue too.
Okay. Let's listen.
Well, along these lines, and Lauren, you're kind of talking about this idea of being an ally, and around here, and by here I mean Grand Forks, North Dakota, Upper Midwest, people often say that they don't want discussions to get political, and I think what they often mean, not always, but I think what they often mean is they want to try to respect the views of other people, and they don't want to make people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts about the extent to which tension and discomfort and awkwardness can be important in having conversations about controversial issues.
Yeah, discomfort, I don't know, man. Learning the histories of place, learning the histories of the communities and people will really provide a lot of necessary information in how we can continue and move forward through where we're at, I suppose. So a lot, the problem is a lot of this has not been addressed. A lot of it's been falsified in history books. A lot of it's been flipped in a lot of the history's been celebrated as holidays we were talking about, or a lot of this has been these political idols have been put on money that were murdering in our communities. So I don't really care about your discomfort, to be honest. And I care about you, but in the weight of these conversations and things, mm-hmm. it just doesn't hold as much importance as I see the importance of my children not having to answer these questions.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I was going to say sort of discomfort for who, right? Mm-hmm. Who is uncomfortable? Because those are important questions. And growth comes from discomfort. It's uncomfortable to grow. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a difference between uncomfortable conversations and hateful conversations, right? Mm-hmm. Like there can be a really respectful, honest attempt to grapple and understand that can be uncomfortable and often is for all people in that mm-hmm. conversation, but it doesn't have to be hateful, right? And I think sometimes we confuse those two. And another thing is, honestly, it's at this moment in time, and this sort of gets back to the original question, I think it's really hard to have any conversation that isn't in some way political mm-hmm. and to make any art that isn't in some way political. You know, I went to college in Vermont Vermont, so I have like a lot of environmentalist friends and a lot of friends who are like environmental writers, and like that's one of the most political, you know, like mm-hmm. the environment is also weaponized right now mm-hmm. and has been for centuries, but like there's this kind of denialism about climate and stuff like that, so like even if you're just like writing about trees, which is a beautiful thing to do, like that's mm-hmm. also political at this moment in time.
Yeah, I think people don't realize I don't want to talk about politics as a political conversation. The idea, I don't want to get political is a political statement. And it's couched in some incredible degrees of privilege. There are some people, even in America, you know, my tap water temperature is a political discussion, or the contents of what's coming out of my sink. You know, say, you know, every, I can guarantee you every single discussion in Flint, Michigan is political, you know, including where did the paper come from. You know, it reminds me of something that, you know, everybody knows I have a dream from Martin Luther King. Nobody really likes Letter from a Birmingham Jail. That's the one nobody talks about, because he talks about how people who, even well-meaning liberal people, when it comes down to it, we'll always choose order over justice every time. And it sort of it goes into the whole argument about what is an acceptable form of protest. And every single one is not that way, not that way, not that way, not that way. It's because, and it goes back to that, even if you may mean well, your desire for order will always trump your desire for justice. And I think The discussions about justice, we're not even talking about any form of other form of protest, but just the discussions about it are uncomfortable because they disrupt order. And I think that's one of the things we have to start setting aside, that, you know, order does not trump justice.
And that's also reflected, right, in who our heroes are and aren't. I'm working on this story now about the renaming of an elementary school in Berkeley, California, which you can imagine is a very, very charged and exciting conversation in Berkeley. And there's a committee that the school was named after a former slave owner and I think defender of slavery. So it was unanimous that they said, okay, we're going to rename the school. Like Board of Education was like, yep, no problem. There were very few kind of dissenters. But then there's this whole process what do we name it? And who are our heroes? And an interesting thing, and how do we decide? And how do we lift? One of the interesting things to me has been their process of trying to lift up new heroes, because there are a lot of schools across the country named after Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, you know, and it's like, it's like another kind of flattening and tokenism to be like, these are the safe heroes that we've already agreed on. So let's just like keep renaming our schools and streets. Mm-hmm. These like, you know, six people of color who we've decided, you know, are safe and comfortable mm-hmm. heroes for us, and that's, you know, there's a lot more work to do there. Mm-hmm.
That was Lauren Markham, was also a member of this panel.
Yes, she her most recent book is The Faraway Brothers, about two brothers from El Salvador who came as children to the United States.
Well, this is a provocative discussion because obviously they have an intellectual end in what they're writing. They want people to think about things, but they know that in the process of that, they're going to be disturbed about what they've learned.
Yes, and the point of the necessity of disturbance, the necessity of awkwardness is an interesting one, that if we're going to have change, if we're going to progress, there's going to be some discomfort involved, and you just can't avoid it.
It's relevant in our times, too, because if you've been reading the news lately, you know that Lake Calhoun in the Twin Cities has been renamed because it was named for somebody who was a well-known slave owner and racist. And Kauffman Memorial Union, which is a central edifice on the University of Minnesota campus, is in controversy right now because students are talking about changing the name of that because it honors a president who was known to be bigoted and racist in his own right.
He was, yes, quite overtly and proudly.
Yes, president racist. Of the university, I should mention, yes. So this is an important discussion that they're engaged in, and it's important for all of us to think about what it means to be uncomfortable about something, because we're obviously wrestling with it.
Yeah, and I'll say as I read the books and looked at the works of these artists in preparation for talking about them and talking with them, it did. It made me uncomfortable. You know, I can testify. You'll have that experience.
Well, what else are we going to hear?
Well, one of the issues about the kind of work that these artists do who were drawn to this, are invited to this UND Writers Conference, the conference, you remember what the name of it is, the theme of it?
Truth, right?
Truth and lies.
Lies, yes.
Truth and lies. And what they talk about next is the responsibility that they felt to research. They talk about the work that it took to have what they felt was the authority and authenticity to speak on these issues. If they're going to provoke us and make us uncomfortable and say this is truth and not lies, how did they get to the point where they could write these books and say with some degree of weight that this is truth in some fashion?
There's one aspect to the works of these authors and artists that we haven't yet talked about, and that is that their work is extensively researched. And so I was wondering if you could talk about how long it takes to produce a work and the type of research that you conduct for it. And then my follow-up question would be, why is understanding the type of expert, heavily researched expert knowledge important when you're trying to pass along information?
Well, I'll look at you first.
Me? Journalist. Yeah. Well, so research was vital for my story, of course, because it is a work of, it's a journalistic work, it's a work of nonfiction. But, you know, the easiest kind of research, not that it's easy, is the facts and figures and numbers and all that stuff, because there's you know, you can find that stuff. But the what I really I had to spend, and I was grateful for the opportunity to spend a lot of time in El Salvador. I took 5 different trips there to interview extensively the family of the young men that I was writing about, and then I spent countless hours interviewing the young men themselves, because I wasn't just like it was. This isn't a long newspaper article, right? This is a book, and the idea is that it reads like a novel in the sense that you are, you know, one, just as a writer, the sentences matter to me, but as a matter of responsibility and the quality of the sentences, but as a matter of responsibility, like this book needed to be true and fair and, you know, as much as possible, evocative of the actual lived experience of 2 actual people who live in the world and live in the world and their family. So, that sort of on the ground research and interviews was, you know, it's like, That was up till the very last minute. You know, I was making last minute changes on proofs and stuff to just make sure I got it as right as I possibly could, and that was my responsibility to the people I was writing about. It also means though that like, as a journalist, you are asking so much of so many people to give you so much of their time. So that was a big ask.
Yeah, I do a ton of research. The novel that I'm working on now, I spent 2 years just researching it. Then I'll hire people to do more research and so on. I knew I was on the right track because I still get asked by more history departments than English departments, which is interesting. Well, I think, you know, a huge influence on me was this journalist David Carr. And David Carr wrote this memoir called Night of the Gun, which is about his time as a drug addict. And it hit him pretty early on that the last person whose opinions, whose testimony he could trust is a drug addict. So he went and interviewed everybody he interacted with. So tell me how I was back then and so on. The idea that even his experience of the events is still just one person's opinion. And it's very important to me. And I'm fine with original source documents. Like I'll read tax records, I read ship logs, stuff like that. Because when I finally sit down to write, I need to feel like I'm moving with some sort of authority. Because I do write from when I start writing, I write straight to the end. So to get to the point where I can write a novel straight to the end, yeah, it means sometimes 1, 2, 2.5, sometimes 3 years of just doing nothing but research and so on. Also, research for me also allows for certain things to happen that I wouldn't have thought of before. I get to the point where I think, man, this book is writing itself. Those sort of aspects of a novel that make it, for me at least, make it more like the lives of real people, you know, come through those things. The thing about, because I write mostly historical fiction, the other thing about research, though, is that you have to also become accustomed to bias. So if I'm researching documents written in 1840, there's a lot of unlearning I have to go, like, this is total bish. But it's important, interesting that they wrote it that way, you know. Edward Long had this history of Jamaica where he portrays the local-born white woman as just one degree above wild animal. And this is the history, not Edward Long's repressed opinions of women. It's read as history of Jamaica. So sometimes it's also, even with this book, it's the research, it was interesting, and this becomes, it sort of spilled over into how I look at the world now, going back to the 70s and looking at the history of propaganda and how the media was used in those days. Like, anybody who's been around in the 70s, none of what's happening now with fake news is surprising them. We used to call it propaganda back in those days. So that's it too. To research also makes you become way more discerning in how facts are presented to you, which is a whole different thing, I think.
Yeah, for me, the process of work's always been deeply connected to just my travels through life, really. So my research as an Indigenous artist happens at home. It happens on the land. It happens in subsistence and feeding my family, continuing that connection to place, and it's continued on into the institutions and museums. It's continued on into the anthropological homogenized form of written format on Indigenous communities, which is one thing that is removed from our elders, put into words. So you recognize who's filtering through these identities and stereotypes that a lot of people hold today. And my research also happens here and exchanges out with everybody that I meet while I'm traveling. So it's just continual, and a lot of it is listening. So.
Yeah, just to echo the listening part and a little bit too about the kind of primary source research is that, you know, when I am researching anything, I'm researching central questions, but part of the work of research is, and I'm trying to kind of round that out, and whether that's in archival material or often in the case with what I report, it's like by talking to individuals about their experiences and perspectives. But so it's like you have these research questions, but you also have to be nimble and open enough because all of these surprising things happen and you learn these other things, and it's like, ooh. And if you're too doggedly focused on like, but this is what I'm trying to learn, then you're actually missing like some of the most vital opportunities for learning. And actually, I mean, so many times, right, I'm like, oh, I thought it was this, but it's not. It's this other thing. And that's a responsibility, too.
Yeah, because when the person doesn't do that, there's a book about Jamaica called The Dead Yard. And it's you know, there are parts of it that are really, really good. But you can tell the writer had his conclusion before he even landed.
Uh-huh. Right.
So he will do things to reinforce that conclusion. Like, he'll talk about how landing in Jamaica, all these taxes have 10, 15 people packed in them, and he had to pay to get in. Even though Jamaica has had a pretty, you know, world-class bus service for decades now, that doesn't fit the narrative.
Right.
So he walks past, he bypasses all these empty
in order to
buses,
be like the packed taxi scene.
The packed taxi scene and so on. And I think we do that too often, where we enter situations with a conclusion.
Right.
And then sometimes just look for stuff to back it up. If you're looking for stuff to back up a prejudice, you will find it.
Absolutely. That's what the internet's for.
Confirmation bias.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God.
And we're actually out of time, so I think that's a good note to end on.
But oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
So if you could join me in thanking the panelists.
Moderator Kerry Campbell, the UND Professor of History, talking with Nicholas Gallinan, Marlon James, and Lauren Markham. A lot of food for thought there, Bill.
Yes, and we've had several excerpts from this panel on Main Street, so people can go back, and also interviews with Lauren Markham and another author who's not on this panel, Molly McCulley Brown. So those are at the Main Street website.
Well, thank you for that, and our listeners appreciate, I think, this kind of provocative discussion. Natural North Dakota is next.
Next time on Studio 360, one of America's greatest poets.
I celebrate myself and what I assume you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you.
But even Walt Whitman had his critics.
The man who wrote page 79 of The Leaves of Grass deserves nothing so richly as the public executioner's whip.
Poetry that contains multitudes. Next time on Studio 360.
Tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lora teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, and he writes the Natural North Dakota essays about the flora and fauna that we can see where we live. Today, though, he's writing about some geology. Here's Chuck Lora talking about scoria.
I was recently perusing through Lewis and Clark in North Dakota by Russell Reed from 1948. Which contains the journals of Lewis and Clark as well as the Biddle texts and annotations by the author. I found Clark's journal entry from March 21, 1805 interesting. The expedition had spent the winter at Fort Mandan and would soon continue their travels upstream on the Missouri River. Here's an excerpt from the Biddle text for Clark's journal that day. It's easier to follow than Clark's original entry. And I quote here, "Passed along the points of the high hills, where we saw large quantities of pumice stone on the foot, sides, and tops of the hills, which had every appearance of having been at some period on fire. He collected specimens of the stone itself, the pumice stone, and the hard earth, and on being put into a furnace, the hard earth melted and glazed, the pumice stone melted, and the hard stone became a pumice stone glazed." Unquote. That pumice stone glazed was apparently Clark's introduction to scoria. Scoria, or more accurately, clinker, is formed when a seam of lignite catches fire and burns hot enough to bake the overlying layer of clay, forming a red brick-like material. Western North Dakota has an abundance of lignite deposits that are exposed at the buttes and badlands. Those lignite beds are known occasionally to spontaneously combust. Lightning strikes can also serve to ignite the lignite. And historically, there were frequent prairie fires, some of which were deliberately set by Native Americans to attract the bison or as a backfire to protect villages. If the fire burned hot enough, an overlying layer of clay can be baked, forming scoria. And we still occasionally hear of a lignite vein burning in the western part of the state. Most North Dakotans are familiar with the scoria as a conspicuous red-colored sediment layer visible in the buttes and the badlands in the western part of the state. However, the color can vary due to differences in chemical composition, iron, for example. And because it's often more resistant than other sediments, scoria often forms a cap rock on rougher landscapes. And of course, scoria is also widely used in the western part of the state as surface material for roads and also landscaping. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about some big improvements to the Northwest Arts Center at Minot State University in a discussion with Avis Vikley. She's the director of the center, and she'll also talk about the new Walter Peel Gallery. And we'll get an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast about personalized learning.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. As income tax season heads into the final stretch, North Dakota's tax commissioner says it's been an uneventful season so far.
We're right about, you know, right in the early part of April is when we start to see the influx of a lot of the, you know, the more last minute and paper returns and more complicated returns. We're ramping up with our temporary employment that we do every year. We bring on dozens of folks to come on and help, whether it's, you know, opening up mail, getting checks processed. It's kind of a normal year, which is good.
Ryan Rauschenberger says next year there'll be some changes due to federal tax reform, but he says you won't see any big change in your individual tax forms. The deadline for filing this year is April 17th. North Dakota soybean growers say it's a wait-and-see situation. They're wondering if China will impose retaliatory tariffs on soybean imports from the United States. Monty Peterson is a Barnes County soybean grower.
That would have a negative impact, I think, on us. It certainly could affect market share, could affect market price.
But Peterson says there's another side to this.
Our president and our administration has called for a reduction of the trade deficit with China. On a positive side, I guess U.S. soybean farmers certainly could export more soybeans than they currently are to China. And that would be a help to the trade deficit.
The North Dakota Soybean Growers Association says China annually buys about $1.5 billion in North Dakota-grown soybeans. And April is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The theme for this year's month, or the theme for the month, is Embrace Your Voice. Renee Strami is with the Abused Adult Resource Center in Bismarck.
Well, I think it's most important that we make sure that we're speaking out against it and seeing an end to the behaviors that create a culture that allows violence against women to persist. We hope that survivors will come forward and seek support. And we hope that we just really create an atmosphere and a direction in our communities that is not tolerant of any sort of violent behaviors.
A number of events marking the month are scheduled around North Dakota. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Avis Vikley. She's the director of the Northwest Arts Center at Minot State University. Thanks for joining us, Avis.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about your gallery. It's got something new, and we'll get to that. But tell us about the Northwest Arts Center.
Well, it's a new, totally new renovated space. They have done some work in the It's in the lower level of the existing Gordon B. Olson Library on the campus of Minot State University. And essentially what they did was took a quadrant of the area down there. We have a new gallery exhibit space. We have a nice public reception area. We have some workrooms, storage areas, display cases for our Native American artifact collection. And it's really a nice state-of-the-art gallery. Biggest feature and biggest new feature is that we have climate control, temperature control, and humidity control in the gallery and the storage areas. So that's, you know, just helps us to take better care of the art that we're exhibiting.
And probably better to acquire those visiting exhibits that you might want to take as well.
That's right. Yeah.
How would you describe the mission of the Northwest Arts Center to somebody who wasn't, familiar with it?
Well, we really want to make art accessible to the people of, especially in northwestern North Dakota. That's why the Northwest is in our name. We also added an S to arts in our name, so we're now the Northwest Arts Center, and we, you know, really want to support all sorts of different disciplines in the arts. For our grand opening, we'll be featuring poetry, a Native American flutist, some student musicians from the MSU music department, as well as fine arts. So people in this region now have, I think, a really good center to attract them to come and see and experience art, and not just the fine arts, but other things as well.
You mentioned the Native American art and artifacts that you have there. Is there a particular focus? You talked about Northwest North Dakota. Are there artists that you're celebrating in particular?
Well, for the opening, we are featuring the work of Walter Peel, Jr. He's been a longtime faculty member in the art department at Minot State. And he's really our probably as close as we have to a famous person. He's really has a national and international reputation in the art world as an abstract expressionist painter. I had an interesting experience. I was teaching a drawing class a couple summers ago, and we were looking through the the drawing textbook that we had, and there was a Walter Peale drawing in there. So, you know, we're really happy to honor his work and his, you know, his service to MSU, his role as an educator, and all the people that he's touched.
His style is very distinctive. You see horses, lots of horses, and bold colors, and the motion is obvious. These animals are not standing still.
That's right. And he's, you know, he's known as a Western artist or Americana, but he treated it in a way that was not, you know, the typical thing that you saw with, you know, like Charlie Russell art or whatever. He took it into the expressionist and just a more fine art, not so exactly realistic sort of interpretation, but yet it really captures the spirit of the rodeo and the things that he was involved in when he was younger.
Oh, I really love his work. I know other people do too, obviously. He's well known. And now you have the Walter Peale Gallery at the Northwest Arts Center.
That's right.
So it must be pretty exciting for him to be a living artist with a gallery named after him.
Well, you know, I think he's tolerating the attention. I think, you know, he's really an icon here, and we're just happy to honor him this way. And he's being, like I said, he's being tolerant about it. And, it's just been a fun thing. We've had a few, conversations with him, have gone, out to his studio, looked over different things and had an opportunity to just talk with him about his art, you know, this piece, why did you do this, you know, or what's the background behind this series? And it was just fun to have that kind of insight into his work and how it's developed over the years.
Does he still operate the Blue Rider Bar in Minot?
He does, yes.
That's another place to see Walter Peale's work, as a matter of fact. And he's still an art professor at Minot State.
Well, he just recently retired.
Okay.
Just recently retired, yeah. But he's still around. He, you know, stops by the campus every once in a while and still very active in things, especially, you know, with the new center. He's been, you know, very involved with planning and things for that. So,
Tell us about the grand opening celebration for the Northwest Arts Center and the new Walter Peale Gallery at Minot State.
So we have been in the space actually since January. We hung the first exhibits. We wanted to do a couple of shows just to basically find out how the space worked, how to turn on the lights and turn them off. But our grand opening will be April 19th, and we're going to feature in the main gallery a retrospective of Walter's work. And then we have some special guests. We have Mandan Hadatsa, storyteller and musician Keith Baer from Newtown, who will be playing flute and doing some. He has written a special honor dance, or honor, I'm sorry, he's written a special honor song for the celebration. We also have cowboy poet, singer, and songwriter D.W. Grothy from Bainville, Montana, who will be doing some original poetry. And so both of those people are sort of part of the dedication ceremony that evening. And then we've invited the entire state, I think.
And is this free and open to the public then?
It is free and open to the public, yeah. It's we are starting about 5 p.m. with just some, we'll have some soft background music and kind of a social hour. The dedication program itself will start at 6:15, and we'll have, you know, a few speakers. Walter will have a few things to say. We are also going to recognize our major donors, which would be Doris Slotin and also the Wesley family estate, who, you know, in this time of budget cuts around the state, the new facility was funded all by private donations. You know, we really have a lot of thanks to go to the MSU Foundation and the people that they worked with and these sponsors that I mentioned that helped to fund this. It's just a beautiful new facility.
And Avis Vikley, the director of the Northwest Arts Center at Minot State University, how many pieces of Walter Peale's work do you possess in the permanent collection?
Well, that's a little negotiable.
Okay.
We have a couple in the collection right now. Part of the whole process here is he will be identifying certain pieces, and we'll consult with him on this, and he'll be donating pieces of his work to the permanent collection. We don't have a certain number. We don't have a certain number right now that we know, this is X number, but it's something that's part of this whole process of curating the show and going through and doing a retrospective of his work.
Certainly adds to the value of the place because his work is, of course, well-known and very much appreciated. What are the hours, the normal hours of operation for the Northwest Arts Center? And again, its access is open to the public.
Yeah, that's right. We have the gallery open from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. And we do have other hours by appointment. One of the things that we have established with the new facility is that it's separate and self-contained apart from the library. So we can be open for evening events, when the library isn't open. So we've had some openings and receptions in the evenings. The other thing that is really nice about the new facility is we have much better access for the public. We have a new entrance right off the south side of the library building, so it's at ground level for parking right there. Handicap spaces right in front of the door. And if people want to come during the day, we have guest passes available for parking. So it's just going to be much more convenient and accessible and open for public people who want to come to the exhibits.
Well, it's a wonderful new attraction for Minot State University. The grand opening of the Northwest Arts Center and the Walter Peale Gallery at Minot State will be Thursday, April 19th from 5 until 8 p.m. Avis Vikley is the director of the Northwest Arts Center. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Well, thanks so much for your interest.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Brave the Shave is back and gearing up for the main event on Saturday, April 14th at Bismarck's YMCA. Brave the Shave is on a mission to fight childhood cancer through family support and research. Since 2007, Brave the Shave has raised over $2.7 million and has helped more than 70 families here in North Dakota, one shaved head at a time. You can join the fight by going to bravetheshave.net to form your team, volunteer to shave, learn how to donate, or become a volunteer. All proceeds go to cancer research and to help local families impacted by childhood cancer. Learn more at bravetheshave.net.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we have another excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast. It features host Tom Gerhart in a conversation with Matt Williams of KnowledgeWorks, a national organization that aims to provide students with personalized learning experiences. KnowledgeWorks has a presence in North Dakota and many other states.
Why North Dakota?
The interesting thing, and I think Kirsten Basil and I would tell the same story, is we in many ways started by happenstance. We sat down next to each other at a conference lunch and struck up a conversation about what she at the state level was focused on, which was we really want to explore innovative learning. We want to make sure that we're building capacity at the district level. And I said, well, funny enough, that's what we do at KnowledgeWorks. And then from there, we were able to kind of strike up a plan. And where we came in, a colleague and I really worked with about 10 districts that were really interested in this work. And we had some conversations with them about what it took to kind of build the capacity at a district level. What might the state policies look like? We then reported those findings back to DPI, and in working with Superintendent Basler, we put together a policy audit, which then led to this notion of, gosh, you guys really should do a pilot. And that led to Senate Bill 2186. And obviously, we played a small behind-the-scenes role. It really is a story of, I think, a dynamic leader in Superintendent Basler, as well as her making sure, as well as many others, there was broad-based support. The bipartisan support that existed in this state to move it forward is the critical factor.
From your experience with your background, can you explain why personalized, competency-based education, these innovative approaches to education are so important, so critical?
We need to make sure that we're preparing students for a world that is changing at a rapid pace. It allows for us to have definitive proof that kids have mastered things as they move through the system, so that we don't have these achievement gaps, so we don't have the remediation rates when students do persist to post-secondary, where we're having 30% of the kids needing to go into remedial courses and start the churn, both where they're paying significant amounts of money for things that they should have gotten at the K-12 level. I think the other thing that the reason we lean towards personalized and competency-based approach is the fact that we know that it's not just about content knowledge. That's a critically important piece of it. However, we know that there are skills and dispositions that students need to have to be able to navigate this world. They need to be adaptable. They need to be able to collaborate. They need to be able to critically think and problem solve and be creative and have persistence. Again, when you think about the rapid change in our world, you need those skills to be able to navigate it in an effective way. So that's typically why we look at and say that we need a different form of education.
I saw on the Knowledge Works website, 65% of today's grade school students will end up in a career that doesn't yet exist. How do we prepare for that? That's the big question.
We need to begin to build these skills, the critical skills around being adaptive, being creative, being collaborative, being a good communicator, both in writing and in speaking, and to have a sense of persistence to be able to move through the world. Because, yes, the jobs that certainly my kids, but then even younger kids are going to have, haven't been thought of. And even then, we know that they're going to have multiple jobs or multiple careers over their lifetime because of this evolving economy, this evolving world that we live in.
You helped North Dakota, whatever role that you played with Senate Bill 2186, and you helped other states as well move toward the personalized innovative learning. Talk about that a little bit more.
It really is getting a sense of what that state needs. Our disposition at KnowledgeWorks is that personalized and competency-based learning are the way to go. But how to get there, there are multiple ways to do that. As we work with states, we're looking at the local context. What does that mean for a state like North Dakota versus a state like South Carolina? South Carolina, for example, really led with the business community. They were beginning to attract bigger, more international companies, Boeing, BMW, AT&T, et cetera, to their state. And they needed a different workforce, if you will. And so that was the primary driver. And so it took more of our work with them took more of an economic bent, an economic development bent. Whereas in North Dakota, where nearly 90% of, if not 90% of people in the state think that their public schools are doing a great job. So it was really more about how do we move from a good to a great system. So it was that good to great jump, and also making sure that North Dakota's experiencing change just as the entire country is at a very rapid rate that I don't think a lot of people are aware of. They're outside of the state of North Dakota.
Most states now have some innovative education type bill. What trends are you seeing develop?
There are some states that I would say are further along, like a state like New Hampshire that's for over a decade been investing in competency-based learning through district-level pilots and through kind of policy flexibility. They're somewhat of a leader. I think the compelling thing about North Dakota is that the vision is there, the leadership is there, and a focus on building capacity at all levels of the system, supporting teachers, is there to where I think North Dakota, with Senate Bill 2186 and many other initiatives to bear, can really begin to leap up as a national leader based on kind of the factors that are here, as well as the fact that I think dynamic leadership matters around education. And whether that's through the leadership of Superintendent Baszler, the governor, North Dakota United, and the chamber, that leadership exists here.
Talk about what you're seeing and how students seem to be responding better to this type of learning and how teachers seem to be enjoying their time in the classroom more.
You see teachers that, particularly over the last 15 years with No Child Left Behind, had been handed here's what you will teach. Here's the curriculum, the scope and sequence, and the content that you will teach. That's not why people went into teaching. This allows them to say, okay, I have state standards I need to meet, I have competencies I need to move my students through. How am I going to choose that? Which means that you might take a totally different path. It could be an American history class, but that doesn't mean that we're going to just go walk through the textbook. It could be that we're going to dive into some areas that are interesting to students so they can really begin to move these areas forward in their learning. Because fundamentally across that, they need to be able to research, they need to be able to read, they need to be able to document, they need to be able to understand the connections between this event and that event. Memorizing the events are less important. So how do you begin to apply that knowledge is important, which is why teachers go in to teach it.
Opportunities. What exists?
The biggest opportunity is to meet our students where they are and move them to where they should be, could be, and can be. I think our system, unfortunately, that we currently have sometimes sucks the potential out and certainly the engagement out. And I think we're able to give that back in into a personalized environment. So that's one of the biggest opportunities. Some of the biggest challenges, I think, are human capital. How do we get teachers the professional development they need to be able to navigate a personalized system? And I think one of the bigger issues that's facing this kind of movement is around definitions. And it's the boring lexicon stuff is you say innovative learning, I say personalized learning, you say competency-based learning, another person says mastery learning. So some sense of agreement or at the very least understanding and maybe some level of tolerance as we use multiple terms that sometimes mean the same thing and sometimes mean different things. So I think that's also a piece that is kind of a critical barrier right now.
In terms of schools or administrators or districts moving forward, is mindset one of the most important things?
Absolutely. I think it is foundational. The mindset's critically important because the system that we have now, traditional system of education in this country, is a compliance system. Sit quietly, fill out the papers, whatever they might be, write the papers, turn everything in on time, and then we'll give you a diploma at the end. And in the world that we live in, that isn't good enough anymore. That there are skills that we know students need to have in addition to the content knowledge. There is a mindset, whether it's the adaptability piece, the persistence piece, a growth mindset where you aren't fixed in on any one thing, but you're able to navigate and be resilient. I think resilience is one of the things that we can't underscore enough in an ever-changing world, is students being able to really grasp what's going on, take the setbacks and the failures as they come, because they do, just as the successes do, learn from them, reset, and move forward.
Cutting Ed podcast host Tom Gerhart in a discussion with Matt Williams of KnowledgeWorks. The Cutting Ed podcast is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dinter-Smith. Dakota Datebook is next.
The State Historical Society of North Dakota, as part of their Sensational Sunday series, presents the Good Government Summit, a timely discussion about ethics in government and how North Dakota citizens rate theirs. Sunday, April 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. Humanities scholar and host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson, will portray the third president live and in costume. Merrill Pepcorn will read a Dakota Datebook. And Main Street's Doug Hamilton will moderate a distinguished media panel that includes Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson, along with Amy Dalrymple of the Bismarck Tribune, the Grand Forks Herald's Mike Jacobs, Cecile Warman of Journal Publishing, and Forum Communications' Jack Zaleski. The event is free and open to the public. More information at history.nd.gov/events. The Good Government Summit, Sunday, April 15th, 1 to 4 p.m. in Bismarck.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 3rd. The first Dakota baseball players were soldiers who brought the game from the East. By the time North Dakota became a state, nearly every small town had a team. Documented teams in Dakota Territory included Fargo, Grand Forks, Larimore, Grafton, and Valley City. Teams sometimes traveled as far as St. Paul and Manitoba. The telegraph made it possible for newspapers to print the results of games, and baseball proved to be inexpensive entertainment for settlers on the frontier. The first known baseball organization in Dakota Territory was the Red River Valley Baseball Club. It was established in Fargo in 1875. Grand Forks organized a similar club in 1879. The Grand Forks team was called the Dakota Stars. In 1883, newspapers reported the results of games between the Fargo and Grand Forks teams. It was a heated rivalry. When the St. Paul Brown Stockings defeated the Fargo Blues 26-3, the Grand Forks Daily Herald ran a report of the game on the front page. During one game between the two teams, an umpire quit in disgust. The Fargo team once hired a crack pitcher to play for the Wahpeton team in a meeting with Grand Forks. But local baseball came and went, depending on local support and the money available to support the teams. On this date in 1906, the Evening Times lamented that Grand Forks might not be able to secure a team for the upcoming season. Mr. Stanchfield, the primary backer of the team, said he and his partner could not carry the team any longer. He said he wouldn't take any further interest in baseball unless other businessmen provided some support. He said he was looking at losses of $2,000 to $3,000 for a season. He was willing to do his part, but he said he will not pay for the sport of the city out of his own pocket. Stanchfield came up with a plan to sell stock to raise money for a team. His efforts were successful. On May 24, 1907, the Botineau Courant newspaper reported that Minnesota had defeated Grand Forks in a ragged baseball game by a score of 17-2. But baseball remained alive and well in Grand Forks. Today's Dakota Day Book is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
What some Memphis residents remember about Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. coming to town was the fear.
Dr. King wasn't universally popular because of him being a lightning rod. And so even for those who you want to bring change to, there's fear. There was anxiety.
A look at how King's assassination is remembered in the town where he was killed. We are live from Memphis on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-7777. 6377. We want to hear from you.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll hear about the concern over pensions for public and private employees. Dennis Curran heads organizations to protect pensions. Curran drove for UPS, one of the many companies moving away from traditional pensions. And a new opera offers a contemporary theme in soldier songs. A touring performance will be hosted by the Fargo-Moorhead Chamber Opera this weekend, and we'll talk with David Hamilton of the Fargo-Moorhead Opera about this interesting event. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.